Gordon Bellow is an executive director of POCAS on the Global South, a program of research, analysis and advocacy of the Chulalongkorn University Social Research Institute in Bangkok, Thailand, and also a professor of sociology and public administration at the University of the Philippines. He's also an author or co-author of 11 books on Asian economic and political issues, including A Siamese Tragedy, Development and Disintegration in Modern Thailand, and Dragons in Distress, Asia's Macroeconomies in Crisis. From the activist point of view, Gordon Bellow is a long-time analyst and critic of the World Bank and the IMF, has also an concentrates on the experience of this policy in Asia, mainly Philippines and Thailand. He's been active in a movement against the World Trade Organization. He has tried to link military and economy dimensions of globalization. Now, he is a national chairperson of the Citizens Action Party of the Philippines. By the way, he was also active during the mobilization for Seattle, and he got beaten up there by the police. Okay, so let's start, and I would like to invite Mr. Warden Bellow to the platform. There will be an introduction and afterwards plenty of time for debate.
Well, first of all, let me thank the organizers of this very historic gathering here today. I can sense the same feeling that we had in Seattle during the pre-demonstration mobilizations when we had the massive teach-in at Benaroya Hall. I feel that the mood here is electric, and that this teach-in is a sharing, but it is not a sharing for academic purposes. I feel that it is a preparation for battle. I am fortunate to have been a witness to a number of historic events in less than a year's time, partly because of the accident of being there, and partly because of the pull of being there. Certainly, what happened in Seattle was magical. Things came together in a very special way, and the world will never be the same again. In April 15 and 16, 40,000 people came down or went to Washington, D.C. to try to shut down the spring meetings of the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund. Those meetings took place, but under heavily fortified conditions, in a situation of unprecedented protest against the fund and the bank. This rolling wave, which picks up more and more people and escalates more and more and grows bigger and bigger, crashed into Melbourne, Australia 2 weeks ago when Bill Gates and his buddies in the World Economic Forum came together to try to figure out how to deal with us. And they found themselves trapped in the Crown Casino in Melbourne, where they hold the World Economic Forum conference, to the point that many delegates could not enter because of a blockade, and many delegates could not leave. So, the South Pacific has spoken, and finally, I mean, now, and I know this is not going to be final, the wave has come to Prague. And in the next few days, our movement will be tested. Now, the historic Prague Spring of 1968 spelled the beginning of the end of the Soviet Empire. Will Prague join Seattle in December 1998 and Washington, D.C. in April and Melbourne just 2 weeks ago as one of the catalytic events that would form a critical mass of global citizens to begin to form and to turn the tide against corporate-led globalization? Let me say that I believe it will. And if I am here today, I am not here really for an academic discussion on globalization and its alternatives, although that is very important. I am really here to be one of you to try to shut down the World Bank and the IMF. We come to a crossroads here. For years we were told that globalization was benign, that it was a process that brought the greatest good for the greatest number, that good citizenship lay in accepting the impersonal rule of the market, and good governance meant governments getting out of the way of market forces and letting the most effective incarnation of market freedom, the transnational corporation, go about its task of bringing about the most efficient mix of capital, land, technology, and labor. The unrestricted flow of goods and capital in a world without borders was said to be the best of all possible worlds. Though, when some observers pointed out that to be consistent with the precepts of their 18th century prophet Adam Smith, proponents of the neoliberal doctrine would also have to allow the unrestricted flow of labor to create this best of all possible worlds, they were quite simply ignored. Such inconsistencies could be overlooked, since for over two decades, neoliberalism, or as it was more grandiosely styled, the Washington Consensus, had carried all before it. As one of the key partisans of this doctrine remarked nostalgically recently, and I quote, "The Washington Consensus seemed to gain near universal approval and provided a guiding ideology and underlying intellectual consensus for the world economy, which was quite new in modern history," unquote. Now, the unrestricted flow of speculative capital in accordance with Washington Consensus doctrine was what our governments in East Asia institutionalized in the early 1990s under the strong urging of the International Monetary Fund and the U.S. Treasury Department. The result, the $100 billion that flowed in between 1993 and 1997, flowed out in the back of an eyelash during the Great Panic of the summer of 1997, bringing about the collapse of our economies and spinning them into a mire of recession and massive unemployment from which most still have to recover. Since 1997, financial instability, or the constant erosion of our currency, has become a way of life under IMF-imposed monetary regimes that leave the value of our money to be determined day to day by the changing whims, moods, and preferences of foreign investors and currency speculators. The Asian financial crisis put the International Monetary Fund on the hot seat, leading to a widespread popular reappraisal of its role in the Third World in the 1980s and early 1990s, when structural adjustment programs built on the principles of deregulation, liberalization, and privatization. These programs were imposed on over 90 developing countries and what they called transitional economies in Eastern Europe. After over 15 years, there were hardly any cases of successful adjustment programs. What structural adjustment had done instead was to institutionalize stagnation in Africa and Latin America alongside rises in the levels of absolute poverty and income inequality. Structural adjustment and related free market policies that were imposed beginning in the early 1980s were the central factor that triggered a sharp rise in inequality globally, with one authoritative UN study covering 124 countries, showing that the income share of the richest 20% of the world's population rose from 69 to 83% between 1965 and 1990. Adjustment policies were a central factor behind the rapid concentration of global income in recent years, a process which in 1998 saw Bill Gates, with a net worth of $90 billion, Warren Buffet with $36 billion, and Microsoft co-founder Paul Allen with $30 billion, all Americans by the way, achieve a combined income that was greater than the total combined income of the 600 million that lived in the world's 48 least developed countries, a great number of which had been subjected to World Bank IMF adjustment programs. Structural adjustment has also been a central cause of the lack of any progress in the campaign against poverty. The number of people globally living in poverty, that is, on less than a dollar a day, increased from 1.1 billion in 1985 to 1.2 billion in 1998 and is expected to reach $1.3 billion this year. According to a recent World Bank study, the absolute number of people living in poverty rose in the 1990s in Eastern Europe, South Asia, Latin America and the Caribbean, and Sub-Saharan Africa, all areas that came under the sway of adjustment programs. Confronted with this dismal record, James Wolfensohn of the World Bank had the sense to move the institution away from its identification with structural adjustments, with public relations initiatives like the Structural Adjustment Program Review Initiative that he said would be jointly conducted with NGOs. The IMF, however, under the doctrinaire Michel Camdessou, refused to see the handwriting on the wall. The IMF sought instead to embed adjustment policies permanently in the economic structure through the establishment of the so-called Extended Structural Adjustment Facility, or ESA. Yet, as a consequence of greater public scrutiny following its disastrous policies in East Asia, the fund could no longer pretend that adjustment had not been a massive failure in Africa, Latin America, South Asia, and Eastern Europe. During the World Bank IMF meetings in September 1999, the fund conceded failure by renaming the ESA the, quote, Poverty Reduction and Growth Facility, unquote. There was no way, however, that the fund could successfully whitewash its policies. When the G7 proposed to make IMF certification a condition for eligibility in the now defunct Highly Indebted Poor Country Initiative, or the Debt Reduction Initiative, Representative Maxine Walters of the U.S. House of Representatives spoke for many liberal and conservative American lawmakers when she commented, and I quote, "Do we need to involve the IMF at all? Because, as we have painfully discovered, the way the IMF works causes children to starve," unquote. So starved of legitimacy was the fund that U.S. Treasury Secretary Larry Summers, who in an earlier incarnation as chief economist of the World Bank was one of the chief backers of structural adjustment, was forced to tell the U.S. Congress that, quote, "The IMF-centered process of macroeconomic policy making would be abandoned and replaced by a new, more open and inclusive process that would involve multiple international organizations and give national policymakers and civil society groups a more central role," unquote. I think it was Hegel who said that freedom lies in the recognition of necessity. Freedom, the proponents of neoliberalism, like Hegel's contemporary disciple Francis Fukuyama, tell us, lies in the recognition of the inexorable irreversibility of free market globalization. Thank God the 50,000 people who descended on Seattle in late November 1999 did not buy this Hegelian Fukuyama notion of freedom as submission and surrender to what seemed to be the ineluctable necessity of the World Trade Organization. In the mid-1990s, the WTO had been sold to the global public as the linchpin of a multilateral system of economic governance that would provide the necessary rules to facilitate the growth of global trade and the spread of its beneficial effects. Nearly 5 years later, the implications and consequences of the founding of the WTO had become as clear to large numbers of people as a robbery carried out in broad daylight. What are some of these realizations? First, by signing on to the Agreement on Trade-Related Investment Measures, or TRIM, developing countries discovered that they had signed away their right to use trade policy as a means of industrialization. By signing on to the Agreement on Trade-Related Intellectual Property Rights, or TRIPS, countries realized that they had given high-tech transnationals like Microsoft and Intel the right to monopolize innovation in the knowledge-intensive industries, and provided biotechnology firms like Novartis and Monsanto the go signal to privatize the fruits of eons of creative interaction between human communities and nature, such as seeds, plants, and animal life. By signing on to the Agreement on Agriculture, developing countries discovered that they had agreed to open up their markets while allowing the big agricultural superpowers, the United States and the European Union, to consolidate their system of subsidized agricultural production that was leading to the massive dumping of surpluses on those very markets, a process that was in turn destroying peasant, smallholder-based agriculture. By setting up the WTO, countries and governments discovered that they had set up a legal system that enshrined the priority of free trade above every good, every other good, above the environment, above justice, above equity, and above community. They finally got the significance of consumer advocate Ralph Nader's warning a few years earlier that the WTO was a system of, quote, trade uber alles, unquote, or trade above everything else. In joining the WTO, finally, developing countries realized that they were not, in fact, joining a democratic organization, but one where decisions were made, like the WTO, on the majority of the member countries. The Seattle Ministerial brought together a wide variety of protesters from all over the world, focusing on a wide variety of issues. Some of their stands on key issues, such as the incorporation of labor standards into the WTO, were sometimes contradictory, it is true. But most of them, whether they were in the streets or they were in meeting halls, were united by one thing: their opposition to the expansion of a system that promoted corporate-led globalization at the expense of justice, community, national sovereignty, cultural diversity, and ecological sustainability. Seattle was a debacle created by corporate overreach. The ministerial collapse from pressure from these multiple sources of opposition underlined the truth in Ralph Nader's prescient remark made 4 years earlier that the creation of global trade pacts like the WTO was likely to be, quote, the greatest blunder in the history of the modern global corporation, unquote. Whereas previously, Nader said, the corporations operating within a more or less, quote, private penumbra, unquote, made it effectively difficult to crystallize opposition, Nader argued that now that the global corporate strategic plan is out in print, this gives us an opportunity, unquote. Now, as we all know, truth is eternal. But truth only makes a difference in human lives when it becomes power. In Seattle, the truth was joined to the power of the people and became fact. Suddenly, the facts that had been previously ignored or belittled were acknowledged even by the powers that be, whose brazen confidence had been shaken. For instance, that the WTO, the supreme institution of globalization, was in fact fundamentally undemocratic, was recognized even by representatives of its stoutest defenders, the U.S. and the U.K. Listen to U.S. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky after the revolt of the representatives of developing countries that helped bring down the ministerial. And let me quote her. The process was a rather exclusionary one. All meetings were held between 30 and 20 key countries. And that meant 100 countries, 100 were never in the room. This led to an extraordinarily bad feeling that they were left out of the process and that the results had been dictated to them by the 25 or 30 privileged countries who were in the room, unquote. Listen to Stephen Byers, the UK Secretary for Trade and Industry, after the Seattle shock, and I quote, the WTO will not be able to continue in its present form. There has to be fundamental and radical change in order for it to meet the needs and aspirations of all 134 of its members, unquote. So where are we? Just to briefly review. The Asian financial crisis triggered the IMF's crisis of legitimacy. The Seattle ministerial collapse brought the WTO to a standstill. However, under Jim Wolfensohn's command, the World Bank seemed likely to escape the massive damage sustained by its sister institutions. But the torpedo, in the form of the famous Meltzer Commission, found its mark in February of this year. Formed as one of the conditions for the U.S. Congress's voting for an increase of its quota in the IMF in 1998, the commission was a bipartisan body that was tasked to probe the record of the bank and fund with the end in view of coming up with recommendations for the reform of the two institutions. Exhaustively examining documents and interviewing all kinds of experts, the Commission came up with a devastating conclusion that with most of its resources going to the better-off countries of the developing world, and with the astounding 65-70% failure rate of its projects in the poorest countries, the World Bank was irrelevant to the achievement of its avowed mission of global poverty alleviation. And what to do with the bank? The Commission urged that most of the bank's lending activities be devolved to the regional developing banks, development banks. It does not take much, however, for readers of the report to realize that, as one of the Commission's members revealed, and I quote, "It essentially wants to abolish the IMF and the World Bank, a goal that has significant pockets of support in our Congress itself," unquote. Much to the chagrin of Wolfensohn, few people came to the defense of the bank, and it was in a state of shock that the agency held its joint spring meeting with the IMF in a Washington, D.C., that was shut down by some 40,000 protesters. The spirit of demoralization that gripped the bank was conveyed in Wolfensohn's missive to bank staffers before the meeting that, quote, "the next week will be a trying time for most of us," unquote. That the April meeting of the Bretton Woods twins could take place only under heavy police protection, with the use of a system of decoys to breach protesters' lines in order to bring apprehensive delegates to the fortified bunkers at Pennsylvania and 19th Street Northwest in central D.C., spoke volumes about the tattered legitimacy of these two institutions. Why do I keep coming back to the question of legitimacy? Because as the great Italian thinker Antonio Gramsci pointed out, when legitimacy has vanished and is not regained, it is only a matter of time before the structure collapses, no matter how seemingly solid it is. Now, many of the key advocates of globalization realize this in the wake of the joint crisis of the WTO and the Bretton Woods twins. They knew that the strategy of denial that these three institutions deployed in the past would no longer work, and that the aggressive approach of pro-globalization firebrands like Martin Wolf of the Financial Times, who accused NGOs of ignorance and of being what he called an uncivil society, was likely to be counterproductive. To the more sober-minded among the pro-globalization forces, the first thing to do was to recognize the facts. Fact number one, according to the influential free trader C. Fred Bergston, head of Washington's Institute of International Economics, was that, quote, "the anti-globalization forces are now in the ascendancy," unquote. And fact number two, was that central to the response to these forces, quote, "has to be an honest recognition and admission that there are costs and losers, that globalization does increase income and social disparities within countries, and does leave some countries and some groups behind," unquote. Now here is where the Davos process comes in. Davos has been central to the project of re-legitimizing globalization. Now, Davos, high up in the Swiss Alps, is not the center of a global capitalist conspiracy to divide up the world. No. Davos is where the global elite meets under the umbrella of the World Economic Forum to iron out a rough consensus on how to ideologically confront and diffuse the challenges to the system. Meeting shortly after what many regarded as the cataclysm in Seattle, the Davos crew in late January composed the politically correct line. Repeated like a mantra by personalities like Bill Clinton, Tony Blair, Bill Gates, Nike CEO Phil Knight, and World Economic Forum guru Klaus Schwab, the chorus went this way, and I quote, "Globalization is the wave of the future. But globalization is leaving the majority behind. Those voices spoke out in Seattle. It's time to bring the fruits of globalization and free trade to the many," unquote. But it was perhaps British Prime Minister Tony Blair who best articulated the vision and rhetoric of compassionate globalization, or globalization with compassion, or what Blair told the assembled elites who were mesmerized by him in Davos, the third way. Now, one thing that the British public has finally realized about Mr. Blair is that with him, there is a huge gap between rhetoric and substance. What actually does globalization with compassion, or the third way, have to offer? To find out, one must turn from Blair to Bergsten, who, to his credit, dispenses with the soaring third way rhetoric and admits that the program is actually a system of, quote, "transitional safety nets to help the adjustment to dislocation and enable people to take advantage of globalization and roll with it rather than oppose it," unquote. In short, instead of being run over by the globalization express, people will be asked to quietly and peacefully roll over and adjust to the constant and unpredictable change wrought by the TNC's search for profitability. Now, as important as the rhetoric in the Davos response is the process of bringing people onto the bandwagon. And this would be achieved through dialogue, consultation, formation of partnerships with TNCs, governments, the United Nations, and civil society organizations. The United Nations was a piece of cake. We have just had Kofi Annan and 44 transnational corporation executives, including very gross human rights violators, sign a compact that would supposedly commit these corporations to respecting environmental, labor, and human rights. Let me not speak more about that compact, because we can deal with it in the question and answer if you have not already dealt with it. As for civil society organizations, they are not as naive as Annan and the United Nations, and thus neutralizing them demands more sophisticated measures. And these measures have been pioneered by Jim Wolfensohn. And the strategy is to divide NGOs into what he calls reasonable NGOs that are interested in a serious debate and unreasonable NGOs whose agenda is to close down discussion. Basically, and let me rush through this, this is really what I would call disarmament through dialogue. I think that we are now confronted with major issues in this movement against corporate-led globalization that will determine if our movement will move forward or it will move backward. Let me be specific. Will NGOs breathe life into a WTO process that is at a standstill by pushing for the incorporation of labor and environmental clauses into WTO agreements instead of reducing the power and authority of this instrument of corporate rule by doing all in their power, for instance, to prevent another trade round from ever taking place, Will NGOs throw a lifesaver to the Bretton Woods institutions by participating in the civil society, World Bank, IMF consultations that are to be the central element of the so-called comprehensive development framework that Wolfensohn and the IMF leadership sees as the key to the re-legitimation of the Bretton Woods twins? Will NGOs allow themselves to be sucked into the Davos process of, quote, reasonable dialogue, unquote, or, quote, frank consultation, when one side sees dialogue and consultation mainly as the first step to the disarmament of the other side, the disarmament of our side? Our tactics will depend not only on the balance of forces, but even more fundamentally, will turn on our answer to the question, should we seek to transform or to disable the main institutions of corporate-led globalization? Now, institutions should be saved and reformed if they're functioning while defective. Nevertheless, can be reoriented to promote the interests of society and the environment. They should be abolished if they have become fundamentally dysfunctional. Perhaps we can best appreciate the current situation by borrowing from Thomas Kuhn's classic Structure of Scientific Revolutions. Now, scientific paradigms, says Kuhn, enter into crisis when they can no longer explain or handle dissonant data after dissonant data thrown up by observation. At this point, the community of science diverges in its response. Some try to salvage the dominant paradigm with endless minute adjustments that merely prolong its inevitable demise. A brave few try to cut cleanly from it in favor of a simpler, more elegant, and more useful paradigm, in a manner similar to the way the founders of early modern science simply junked the old, hopelessly complex Ptolemaic paradigm for explaining the cosmos, the sun and other celestial bodies moving around the Earth, in favor of the simpler Copernican paradigm, or the Earth moving around the sun. Like scientific paradigms in crisis, the dominant institutions of globalization can no longer handle the multiple problems thrown up by the process of corporate-led globalization. Instead of trying to reform the multilateral institutions, would it in fact not be more realistic and cost-effective, to use a horrid neoliberal term, to move to disempower, if not abolish them, and create totally new institutions that do not have the baggage of illegitimacy, institutional failure, and Jurassic mindsets that attach to the IMF, World Bank, and the WTO? Indeed, I would contend that the focus of our efforts in Prague and in the future is not to try to reform the multilateral agencies, but to deepen the crisis of legitimacy of the whole system. Gramsci once described the bureaucracy as but, quote, an outer trench behind which lay a powerful system of fortresses and earthworks, unquote. We must no longer think simply in terms of neutralizing the multilateral agencies that form the outer trenches of the system, but of disabling the transnational corporations that are the fortresses and the earthworks that constitute the core of the global economic system. I am talking about disabling not just the WTO, the IMF, and the World Bank, but the transnational corporation itself. And I am not talking about a process of re-regulating the TNCs, but of eventually disabling or dismantling them as fundamental hazards to people, society, the environment, to everything we hold dear. Now, is this off the wall? Only if we think that the shocking irresponsibility and secrecy with which the Monsantos and Novartises have foisted biotechnology on us is a departure from the corporate norm. Only if we see as deviations from the normal Shell's systematic devastation of Ogoni land in Nigeria, the Seven Sisters' conspiracy to prevent the development of renewable energy sources in order to keep us slaves to a petroleum civilization, Rio Tinto and the mining giants' practice of poisoning rivers and communities, and Mitsubishi's recently exposed 20-year-old cover-up of a myriad of product safety violations to prevent a recall that would cut into profitability. Only if we think that it is acceptable business practice and ethics to pull up stakes, lay off people, and destroy long-established communities in order to pursue ever cheaper labor around the globe, a process that most PMCs now engage in. No, these are not departures from normal corporate behavior. They are normal corporate behavior. And corporate crime against people and the environment has, like the mafia, become a way of life because, as John Gray tells us, and I quote, global market competition and technological innovation have interacted to give us an anarchic world economy, unquote. To such a world of anarchy, scarcity, and conflict created by global laissez-faire, Gray continues, and I quote, Thomas Hobbes and Thomas Malthus are better guides than Adam Smith or Friedrich von Hayek with their utopian vision of a humanity united by the benevolent harmonies of competition. Unquote. Smith's world of peacefully competing enterprises has, in the age of the PNC, degenerated into Thomas Hobbes' war of all against all. Gray goes on to say that, quote, as it is presently organized, global capitalism is supremely ill-suited to cope with the risks of geopolitical conflict that are endemic in a world of worsening scarcity. Yet, a regulatory framework for coexistence and cooperation among the world's diverse economies figures on no historical or political agenda. Unquote. Recent events underlie this point. When the ice cap on the North Pole is melting at an unprecedented rate, and the ozone layer above the South Pole has declined by 30%, owing precisely to the dynamics of this corporate civilization's insatiable desire for growth and profits, the need for cooperation among peoples and societies is more stark than ever. We must do better than entrust production and exchange to entities that systematically and fundamentally work to erode solidarity, discourage competition, oppose regulation, accept profit-enhancing and monopoly-creating regulation, all in the name of the market inefficiency. Now, it is said that in the age of globalization, nation-states have become obsolete forms of organization. I disagree. It is the corporation that has become obsolete. It is the corporation that serves as a fetter to humanity's movement to new and necessary social arrangements to achieve the most quintessentially human values of justice, equity, democracy, and to achieve a new equilibrium between our species and the rest of the planet. Disabling, disempowering, or dismantling the PMC should be high on our agenda as a strategic end. And when we say this, we do not equate the PNC with private enterprise, for there are benevolent and malevolent expressions of private enterprise. We must seek to disable or eliminate the malevolent ones, like the mafia and the PNC. Let me then go to the last section, because it is often said that we must not only know what we are against, but what we are for. I agree, though it is very important to know very clearly what we want to terminate so that we do not end up unwittingly fortifying it So that like a WTO 45 with social and environmental clauses, it is given a new lease on life. Let me end, therefore, by giving you my idea of an alternative. It is one that has been formulated for a third world and specifically Southeast Asian context. Let me call this alternative route to the future deglobalization. What is deglobalization? And I do not make any claim to originality. I have shamelessly pirated from many of you, many colleagues, and I hope you don't sue me on the basis of pirating trade-related intellectual property rights. What is deglobalization? I am not talking about withdrawing from the international economy. This is a parody that only exists in the mind of Martin Wolf and the Financial Times. What are we about? We're speaking about reorienting our economies from production for export to production for the local market. About growing most of our financial resources for development from within, rather than becoming dependent on foreign investment and foreign financial markets. About carrying out the long-postponed measures of income redistribution and land redistribution to create a vibrant internal market that would be the anchor of the economy. About de-emphasizing growth and maximizing equity in order to radically reduce environmental disequilibrium. About not leaving strategic economic decisions to the market, but making them subject to democratic choice. About subjecting the private sector and the state to constant monitoring by civil society. About creating a new production and exchange complex that includes community cooperatives, private enterprises, and state enterprises, and excludes PNCs. About enshrining the principle of subsidiarity in economic life by encouraging production of goods to take place at the community and national level if it can be done so at reasonable cost in order to preserve community. We are talking, moreover, about strategy that consciously subordinates the logic of the market, the pursuit of cost efficiency, to the values of security, equity, and social solidarity. And let me borrow from Carl Polanyi, we are speaking, in short, about re-embedding the economy in society rather than having society driven by the economy as it is now. The globalization or the re-empowerment of the local and national, however, can only succeed if it takes place within an alternative system of global economic governance. And when we talk about an alternative system, it is really an alternative to this system of monolithic universal rules imposed by highly centralized institutions. To try to supplant this with another global system of rules and institutions, though this may be premised on different principles, is likely to reproduce the same Jurassic trap that ensnared organizations as different as IBM, the IMF, and the Soviet state. And this is the inability to tolerate and profit from diversity. In other words, what we need is a pluralistic system of economic governance where the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF are significantly reduced in their powers, and institutions like multilateral environmental agreements are raised in their power, and institutions like UNCTAD and the ILO and regional economic organizations are also empowered so that we have a system of checks and balances in the global economy. Pluralism, we know from politics, is good. Why can pluralism not be good for the global economy? Let me then say, in conclusion, more space, more flexibility, more compromise. This should be our goal, to build a new system of global economic governance. It is in such a more fluid, less structured, more pluralistic world with multiple checks and balances, that the nations and communities of the South and the North will be able to carve out the space to develop based on their values, their rhythms, and the strategies of their choice. Let me end by quoting Gray one last time. And I quote, "It is legitimate and indeed imperative that we seek a form of rootedness that is sheltered from overthrow by technologies and market processes, which in achieving a global reach that is disembedded from any community or culture cannot avoid desolating the Earth's human settlements and its human, non-human environment. The role of international organizations in a world where toleration of diversity is a central principle of economic organization would be to express and protect local and national cultures by embodying and sheltering their distinctive practices." Unquote. Let us put an end to this arrogant globalist project of making the world a synthetic unity of individual atoms shorn of culture and community. Let us herald instead an internationalism that is built on, tolerates, respects, and enhances the diversity of human communities and the diversity of life. And let us all remember that all of this and the future, in many ways, may be said to partly hinge on what happens in Prague in the next week. And I ask you to join me and others who have been looking at these institutions for a long time to assert to the world that we are not here to reform the World Bank and the IMF and the WTO. To use a phrase that is common in the United States when you really want to express your feelings, we're here to shut the motherfucker down. Thank you.
Okay, so thanks very much for the introduction. Unfortunately, we've got, well, not so much time, so if we can afford, I think, one or two questions, and then just a very brief conclusion. Good. So if you want to speak, just raise your hand and come in front of the microphone. Okay, so if you could calm down a bit, please, so that we can go on, possibly. Myslím, že poprosit, abyste se ještě utišili, že ještě bude teda pár otázek. Jsem informován, že si to ještě můžeme dovolit časově. A takže se do toho pustme. Jestli se někdo chce přihlásit, otázka, příspěvek, zvedněte ruku. Rád vám dám slovo k mikrofonu, který je uprostřed místnosti. Děkuju.
I would like to ask Holden Bello, what is your opinion about the tomorrow's meeting on the castle, which was named the City of Dialogue? What can be reached in that meeting in terms of fighting these two institutions, and how can people who will not be attending the meeting benefit from this meeting? Will anything come out of the walls of the castle?
That is a great question. I think, let me first say that I, in response to this, that I fully respect President Vaclav Havel, and that I do respect the good intentions that has motivated him to call this meeting. I have accepted to be part of that panel, okay? But let me say that I have accepted to be part of that panel to be able to stress very strongly to a wide variety of audiences, and I believe that this will be globally televised, that what we're after here is not to sweet talk with the World Bank and the IMF and the WTO, but that we are here to militantly criticize these institutions and to say that the process of reform is hopeless and that the best thing for the world is that disabling of these new institutions. I think that if what they expect is a sweet dialogue, I think those of us from the NGOs who have been invited to be part of a panel will make sure that they will get something very different. In other words, I would say that the meeting tomorrow in the palace or the castle, is it the same as Franz Kafka's castle? Yes. In any case, I just remembered, yes, that I see it really as an extension of the main battle. And the main battle will not be in the castle. The main battle will be in the streets. Thank you.
If you could clarify a point that I think is crucial to what you said. You mentioned institutions that are designed to create financial superstructures such as the WTO and IMF. And you mentioned their policies and conduct. Do you think the fault lies in the structure of these institutions or in the conduct itself? Because if it's the latter, do we really need to shut them down, or we can, by maybe including environmental and social issues into their policies, change them to make them work for the benefit of the world and not as what happens now?
Well, if you ask me, I would say that from the perspective of somebody who has been working on the fund and the bank for a long time, who earlier was part of efforts at reforming these institutions, and finding that even as calls for reform grew louder in the last 20 years, the consequences of these two institutions in fact worsen, and indeed have now created an iron cage that imprisons countries in the third world. If you ask me, it is not simply the conduct or the process of these institutions that is problematic. It is the very structure of these institutions. And I think these structures are bound up with the structures and processes that are driven by transnational corporations. And of course, we are not seeing only the economic agencies here. We also still need to talk about, though not maybe this afternoon, the political and military agencies of this whole interrelated structure. So I would say, therefore, that if we have a very dispassionate view of the consistent failure of reform over the last 25 years, and believe me, people trying to reform these two institutions, okay, were doing it before many of you were born, okay? A dispassionate analysis leads you to only one thing, we really need to shut these institutions down. What Wolfenson and Kohler and Michael Moore are offering to us is a rhetoric of pacification. It's one that is designed to lull us from the offensive into a Maginot Line mentality. And I think that we must really, really, really be able to distinguish between the rhetoric of reform, even when the person that says that he's doing the work of God, as Wolfenson continually reminds us these days, that in the reality of the possibility of reform, there is a wide gap in this process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy. And it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of this new institution. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, you know, and that is the systems of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we are talking about the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is US-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Pachkita, wait a second. It was first and then second. Okay. So line up.
Well then, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week, and all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled, what would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development, and if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think let me put it this way. What the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, you know, centralized institutions. Because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy, and it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, you know. And that is the system of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we're talking about the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is U.S.-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Pachketa, wait a second. It was first, and in a second. So line up.
Walden, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week, and all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled, what would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development, and if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think the... Let me put it this way. What the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, you know, centralized institutions, because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy, and it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, you know. And that is the system of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we're talking about the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is U.S.-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Pachketa, wait a second. It was first, and in a second. So line up.
Walden, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week, and all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled, what would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development, and if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think the let me put it this way. What the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, you know, centralized institutions, because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy, and it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, you know, and that is the systems of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we are talking about the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is US-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Wait a second. It was first, and then second. Okay. So line up.
Walden, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week, and all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled, what would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development, and if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think the, let me put it this way, what the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, you know, centralized institutions, because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy, and it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, you know, and that is the systems of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we are talking about the WTO and the World Bank and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is U.S.-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Wait a second. It was first, and then second. Okay. So line up.
Walden, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week, and all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled, what would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development, and if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think let me put it this way. What the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, centralized institutions, because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning, okay, that has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy. And it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us extend the illegitimacy to the very forces that drive these institutions, not in a mechanistic way, of course, because I think we're beyond that sort of vulgar mechanism, and that is the system of the transnational corporations. And I think we must call a spade a spade. And when we talk about transnational corporations, and we are talking about the WTO, and the World Bank, and the IMF, and we're talking about the military, what we are really up against is U.S.-led corporate globalization. There is a national state face to this process of globalization, and we must never forget that. And that is the face of the United States. Thank you.
Pachketa, wait a second. It was first, and then second. Okay. So line up.
Walden, please can you explain what would be the consequences, both negative as well as positive, if the IMF and the World Bank were shut down, say, next week? And all the debts that they owed were cancelled, they defaulted on, all debts owed to them were cancelled. What would happen practically? And following on from that, do you see there a role for some sort of institution which makes international loans for sustainable development? And if so, what would that institution look like?
Well, I think let me put it this way. What the partisans of corporate globalization always tell us is that, okay, you have to approve a system of universal rules imposed by, centralized institutions, because if you don't do that, the alternative is Hobbesian anarchy process. And I would say that it is this gap between the ability to reform these institutions and their real functioning. Okay? That has sunk down or percolated up among many people and created what is now a crisis of legitimacy of these institutions. I mean, these institutions are at a very low point in their legitimacy. And it will be very hard to regain that. And I don't think we should be parties to allowing ourselves to be made part of a process by which we are made to help regain the legitimacy of these new institutions. Rather, as I said earlier, let us